Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Petty. I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here, right? It's nice to be together and in person and see each other. And it's not so nice to smell each other, but it's nice to be here together, right? Thank God for Zoom, though, right? We got to keep doing AA through Zoom. Not everybody liked it. I dug it. I haven't given a talk live since before the pandemic, but I got to do some stuff on Zoom. This is the first talk, though, I've given in a while, I think, in pants. Kind of different, right? Kind of cool. So let's talk about my favorite topic, me. Yeah. I do live in Las Vegas, Nevada. My home group is the Common Solution Group. We meet on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock and on Sunday nights also at 7 o'clock. And if you find yourself in Las Vegas, we'd love to have you come hang out with us. My sponsor is Charlie H., and he knows he's my sponsor. That's important, right? That's important. And my sobriety date is July 17th of 1996, and I'm incredibly grateful for all of those things. I like to drink, right? I mean, I dug it the first time I tried it. I was a little mad when I waited too long, is the truth. I was 9. I wasted a couple of good years, you know. I don't come from an alcoholic home. If that's like some kind of a prerequisite or gives you a certain je ne sais quoi in AA, I don't qualify under that state. My dad told me that he drank once in his life, and he didn't like it because it spoiled his ability to enjoy the situation. My mom has never finished the second glass of wine. I was raised by wolves. Strange people. But my folks got divorced when I was very young. I was 2 years old when my dad left. I was born into a Jewish home. We were a middle-class Jewish home. I had my path was laid out in front of me. I was going to be a doctor or an attorney. There was no variance from that, apparently. But when my dad left, we left this nice middle-class Jewish neighborhood, and we became a Section 8 welfare family on the wrong side of the tracks. And in England, anti-Semitism is different than it is here, and I got in a lot of fights, and growing up was just, it wasn't fun for me. My mom screamed and yelled a lot. She was a lunatic. My dad was completely absent. My brother, who's older than me, he was not equipped to take a parental role, and so he became a bully. I hated my mom, I hated my dad, and I hated my brother. I hated my neighbors. I did. I hated my uncles and my aunts. I hated the kids I went to school with. I didn't know you then, but if I did, I think I would have hated you too. I was just as angry, like upright, and I just didn't like life. And I had this one friend, Barry. Barry was 11. I was 9. So Barry was cool, because when you're 9, all it takes to be cool is 11, right? And I would have done anything Barry wanted to do, and Barry wanted to drink. And it's not like I'd grown up in an alcoholic home, not like I'd been thinking about drinking or wanting to drink. He said, let's drink. I said, anything you want, Barry. I'm grateful that's what he wanted, right? Because can you imagine how much trouble I could have gotten in a drink? Who knows, right? But anyway, he wanted to drink. So we went in front of a liquor store, and we stood there until someone was willing to go in the liquor store and buy us a bottle. Somebody eventually was. We got Old English apple cider, which is just apple juice with a kick, right? We go to this wooded area, and Barry opens this bottle, and he takes a big swig. He hands it to me, and I do what he did. I took a big swing. And what happened next was going to happen almost every time I drank from that day until the day of my last drink. I puked out of my nose. I'm a nose puker. It's just what I am, right? I mean, so if another prerequisite for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, for full-fledged membership, is the ability to drink large quantities of alcohol and handle yourself well afterwards, I failed miserably on that. Some of you are like the big, cool, hotshot drinkers, right? One vodka in your pocket, right? When you drink, you do stuff better than when you're sober, right? You dance better when you're drunk, and you play your instrument better when you're drunk, and you hit on people of the opposite sex or whatever when you're drunk, and God help us all, some of you drive better when you're drunk, right? I'm not that guy. I'm just not. The book says that we are often dangerously and disgustingly antisocial, right? I'm not very dangerous, right? Some of you look pretty scary, but I'm not that guy, but I'm disgusting. What I really am is I'm a hit on your mom, pee on the couch alcoholic. I came to one time after a party, and this husband and wife, they were like friends that I'd been to their house, we'd part, and then I came to, and she won't look at me. She's like in the background, like humping, right? We've all had humps in our life, right? She's walking around, humph, right? And he's like, got that, like the look you're giving me, that kind of look. He's got that stink eye look, and I go, what's wrong? Because you don't remember? No, what happened? He goes, last night, you got so drunk. You hit on her mom, and then you passed out on the couch, and you peed all over the couch. I'm a hit on your mom, pee on the couch alcoholic. I'm not good at drinking, right? I spill things, break things, say embarrassing things, get in trouble. I'm a knucklehead. But I love it because of what happened after I got done puking out of my nose with that kid Barry. See, I'm this uptight kid, right? I come from a broken home. I'm a Jewish kid that lives in the wrong part of town. My parents are split up. We're a poor family. I'm on welfare. I'm short, right? I mean, I'm not a midget or nothing. My son is 20, right? And all the whole time that he was growing up, we do back to back, right? Like you do with your kid. And eventually, back to back, back. I go, you're taller than me, kid. He goes, so? You're short, right? I've always been short. I've always struggled with my weight. I'm this short, fat Jewish kid from the wrong side of the town, broken home, right? I might have self-esteem issues. It hadn't occurred to me until right now that this may be something I should go to therapy for. But anyway, so I'm in this wooded area, and I take this big drink, and I get to hold some of it down, and nothing really happens. But it feels like everything gets fixed, right? It's like for the first time in my life, I can breathe. It feels on an emotional level, it feels like I grow a couple of inches, right? It feels like I lose a couple of pounds. It feels like my foreskin grows back, right? I want you to know that I am properly ashamed of that joke. I really am. I just want to make sure you're listening, right? Not yet, but later there might be something worth listening to. And I just want to make sure you're plugged in. But the truth is that I felt good. And I knew I was going to do that again. And I was going to do it again as much as I could, whenever I could, for as long as I could. And I'm only 9 years old, so I don't become a daily drinker. My mom's kind of strict, and I maybe get drunk a couple more times that year, maybe a few more times when I'm 10, a couple of times. But by the time I'm 13, I'm drinking something, smoking something, taking something, every single possible chance I can get money in my hands to get my what I need to get going. I become a pig. Now, I'm not going to talk about my drug use much, but I do want to tell you this. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got this feeling, and nobody really said it, but I got this feeling like because I drank a lot and did drugs, maybe I didn't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. Almost like when that guy first offered me that dope, I should have said, oh no, I can't do that because in 2022 I'm going to be in Atlanta telling my story. And I don't want to make any of the old timers mad, so I'm just not going to do any of that stuff. But I didn't know. So I said, yes. I didn't know. I tell you, the truth of the matter is that I'm an alcoholic. I have one disease. My disease is alcoholism. And I also did drugs. I did a lot of other things, too, that mean nothing with my alcoholism. They don't matter. It doesn't count. What matters is that when I put beverage alcohol in my system, I can't shut it down. And when I do finally shut it down, never is it my idea. Right? It's usually the boss, her, the cops, right? Somebody shuts it down. I run out of money is typically what happens. When it does get shut down against my will, I can't stay shut down. And this is what is wrong with me. This is what is, but alcoholics shouldn't do drugs. We do them alcoholically. And I'm a pig. By the time I'm 16 years old, I graduate high school. Not because I'm smart, but because I grew up in the north of England, and in England you graduate high school at 16 years old. I stole my diploma. They didn't want to give it to me, right? At 16 years old, I graduate high school, and I joined the family business. I get my own welfare check and my own Section D department. and I just keep drinking. And I'm so much in a mess that towards the end of that year, my dad, who had moved from England to Canada, Canada to Southern California, met and married an American woman and was settled in Southern California, saw me and said, "We're going to fix you. And we're going to bring you to Southern California. And you're going to go to college. We can get you back on track. You get to pick doctor or lawyer, right? We get you back on track. And we're going to fix you." And I don't know much about being fixed. I don't know nothing about going to college. I've seen some shows on TV. California is palm trees, beaches, and pretty girls. And I'm in, right? I'm going to go. And I'm not really sure if Americans drink. Right? Never met any of you. Turns out you do. So it was cool, right? I get to Southern California. And the party's on. I never go to college. I never become an I met some attorneys. And, but anyway, the party keeps going. I don't meet these guys, but I hear of and I get hooked up with and I start running around behind this little rock and roll band called the Grateful Dead, and boy, we have a blast. Yeah. And I'm just partying, and it's working really great. I'm a pitchman. I work at swap meets and county fairs, and I'm selling Ginsu knives and oven cleaners and different gadgets. And at 19 years old, I get discovered by a company called Kenwood, who makes me their national spokesperson. And I am a 19-year-old raging alcoholic on QVC Home Shopping Network with infomercials that run. I work 4 or 5 days a month, and they throw money at me. And this is a bad deal for a budding alcoholic. Right? By the time I'm 23 years old, I have drank my way out of that job. Now, actually, I know why they fired me. Because we always know, don't we? When anything bad ever happens in our lives, don't we always know why and whose fault it is, and we got a story about it? And there was a guy, Bernard, and Bernard was an anti-Semite. He didn't like Jews. And that's why I lost that job. That's not what they said. That's not what they said. It was because they thought it was inappropriate to have an alcoholic crack addict as their national spokesperson. We don't have to agree, right? It's their world. It's their world. So I lost that job. I had a good resume. I was able to get a couple more decent jobs, but eventually I can't really get a job, and I don't have a place to live, and I got no money, and I'm becoming a car salesman, and I'm working at different car lots. I'm there for a couple, 3 weeks, and then I get fired, or I don't show up, or I'm bouncing around from job to job. I'm sleeping. And Jews don't homeless well. I wasn't homeless. I would always find someone would let me sleep in their spare room or on their couch, right? But I'm 25 years old, and I feel like my life is over. And I find my way to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got in trouble. I made a phone call. A guy met me at a meeting. I didn't know anything about you guys. He took me to a 7-day detox. I spent 7 days in this indigent detox facility. From there, I went to a halfway house, and I was 25 years old, and I thought my life was over. I thought my life was over because I never really tried to quit drinking before, but I had known for a couple of years that the alcohol and the dope, that the alcohol was the problem, and I knew that if I could just stop drinking, I could I could stop the chaos in my life, and I could put the pieces of my life together, and I got some natural talents and abilities, and I'll be able to put them to work, and I'll be able to have this picket fence life, right? I know that I'd be able to do that. But the problem is that I'm sitting in this halfway house, and I'm about 15, 16 days sober. And I tell you, I always thought, and people have always said, if you could quit drinking, your life would get good. I'm sitting in this place, and I tell you, it's not good. I have this overwhelming sense of impending doom, right? I know that the other shoe's about to drop. I don't know who's going to drop it, but something's going to happen. I got this guilt of the stuff I've done and said to my dad and my mom and the people in my life, and I just feel like garbage, and I got all this remorse and all this angst, and then at the same time, I get this hole that just starts to burn in my gut, where I just don't feel like I fit anywhere, and I'm just kind of, you know, I got that thing, and I just, man, and then my head starts talking to me, and I tell you, it's weird, because it's mean to me, and it's in my voice, right? You know, you're a piece of crap, you've always been a piece of crap, you're always going to be a piece of crap, you've never amounted to nothing, you're never going to amount to nothing, you're worthless, nobody likes you, why should they? And then the other voice is going, have a drink, 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 have a drink. You'll feel better if you have a drink, have a drink, have a drink. And I'm sitting there, and I'm trying, you know, and somebody says, how you doing? And I go, fine. Because what do you say, right? You can't say to someone, well, I'm a little neurotic, full of self-loathing, feeling a little spiritually disconnected, but other than that, everything's good. I mean, you can't tell anybody what's fine. And I sit there, and I tell you, I make it to about 30 days, and I just, here's the thing. I got to take the edge off, right? There's an edge, and it has to come off. And so I get a plan, and I tell you, I think it's a good plan. I do. Here's the deal. I'm not going to get drunk. I am not going to get drunk. If you look at my life, it would be stupid to get drunk. I'm not going to get drunk. But I'm going to go and have one. Maybe two. Three at the most. No more than four. Just so I can get the edge up, so I can breathe, so I can feel... And then I'll be able to think, and we'll be able to figure, and it'll be cool, right? And I go exercise my plan. And I tell you, I don't know what happened. But somehow I burned my life to the ground again. And I come back in AA about a week later, and I say, I'm so sorry I let you down. I'm so sorry, I feel so bad I let you down. I'll never do it again. I'm going to quit forever this time. I mean it. This time it's different. I'm the this time it's different guy. I should wear a t-shirt, right? This time it's different, you know? I'm sorry I let you down, right? Anyway. So when I come back to A and I don't drink, I'm not going to drink. Well, I'm going to drink. It makes no sense. I'm not going to drink my life. I'm going to put my life back together. I've got talents and it's going to be fine. And a week or two later, man, I tell you, this thing starts again, right? And it's the angst and the emptiness and the uncomfortability, and I just can't, and I just, so I'm just, and I'm not going to get drunk. Not. I'm just going to have one. Maybe two, three at the most, no more than four. No more than four. And I'm in this cycle, and I'm getting drunk to get sober, to get sober, to get drunk, to get drunk, to get sober, and I don't know how to stop the cycle. And I don't know how to tell you what's going on with me. But here's what it is. Somebody says in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm 25 years sober, and you guys all clap. And I think to myself, you poor bastard. Because of my point of reference, I think what you offer in Alcoholics Anonymous, at worst, I think it's going to be punishment for my alcoholism. Right? That's what I suspect it is. But at best, what I think you're going to do is you're going to teach me how to live with the misery of sobriety. Right? That's what I think you're going to do here. You're going to teach me how to handle the uncomfortable, empty, lonely, angst-filled, remorse-riddled guilt. You're going to teach me how to survive that. Right? Like, I think this is what happens at meetings. We all show up at the meeting, hi, how are you? I'm fine, fine. My life's terrible. I've got a horrible job. I've got a terrible girlfriend. I've got a nasty place to live. I've got no money. Nobody loves me. My dad's still mad at me. I got warrants out for my arrest, but at least I'm sober. How are you? I'm about the same. See you tomorrow. That's what I think you offer in AA.
One day at a time, goddammit, right?
And I don't think I can handle that. I can't live like that. I'm not going to be able to survive 3 days sober forever, right? When you guys say that one day at a time stuff, it's so funny you say to someone, you know, if I can stay sober, it's really hard. And they go, you know, don't worry about staying sober forever, because in AA we don't do that. We stay sober here one day at a time. And you say it like it's good news, don't you? But to me, when I'm new, it sounds like a prison sentence.
You will be here one day at a time.
Oh, my God. One long, miserable, nasty, horrendous. Ah!
If that's too hard, don't worry. We do it sometimes 1 minute at a time.
No!
I get sober to get drunk to get sober to get drunk. And I do that for three and a half years. Until July of 1996, I stumbled into an AA clubhouse in Las Vegas, and nothing was different. Nothing was different. It was another time where I showed up at AA. I wasn't in more trouble than any other time. I wasn't more depressed than any other time. In fact, I was in less trouble than most of the time, and probably less depressed than most of the time. I just was out of money again, and I had nowhere to go. So I went to AA, because that's where I went. I came to AA so I could mooch a couple of cigarettes. Someone would buy me a hamburger. It was a safe place to hide. Until next time I drank it, I knew I was going to drink again. And if you ask me why, I would tell you I don't know why. But I know I'm going to drink again. I know I am, and I only know that because I always do. It's what I do. I'm the do-it-again guy. And a guy walked in that meeting, and they say when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I must have been ready because he appeared. And this man was to sponsor me for the first 20 years of my sobriety, and this man saved my life. And he said things that I don't think I'd ever heard before. One of the things he said was, he said that his alcoholism begins where the bag and the bottle ends. And he got my attention. Because what he was talking about was the fact that drinking is the solution for what is wrong with me. Yes, it causes me trouble. Yes, it is problematic. Yes, it is a bad solution. It's probably the wrong solution, but it's all I got. Because what I suffer from is I suffer from abstinence. Abstinence is so painful and so empty and so frustrating and feels like it's going to go on for so long that I can't do it. So I have to drink to escape. Then I went up to him at the meeting and asked him for help, and he said that he would be my sponsor, and we started on a journey through the steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were at his house on a Tuesday night. He has a meeting at his house. He still has the meeting at his house on a Tuesday night. And there was a guy, John, new guy, another new guy. John was, he was kind of squatting in like that. I don't know what you call that, but where you kind of sit on your own legs, right? He was kind of, thin people do it. I tried it once. I sprained my ankle. So I, but he's kind of squatting on his own legs. You know what I'm talking about, right? And he looks up at me and he says, that's a real nasty tone. What are you here for anyway? What do you want out of AA? And it just hit me. I started crying because I didn't know. I didn't know how to answer that question. I didn't know what I was looking for here. I didn't know what was here, let alone what I was supposed to be looking for, right? But I suppose I wanted to know that if I was to come to AA and do AA, I'd be okay. That's what I wanted to know. And I'd been coming here half-heartedly, not getting a sponsor, not doing the steps. If I got a sponsor, I didn't listen to him. If I did the steps, I did them, you know, kind of half-assed. I didn't really have a home group. If I did, I would miss it, you know, for any reason, right? I mean, I wasn't doing AA, right? I wasn't involved and committed. And the sponsor took me through the steps, and it was a weird journey. And I'll give you a little fun sketch of it. We talked about step one. And I tell you, if you've lived my life, you just have to have a 10-minute conversation with me, and one thing becomes apparent, right? I probably shouldn't drink. It's a bad idea for me to drink. Unmanageability. It's funny. In AA, I think we got a little bit off track for me. And if you don't agree with me, that's okay. The only thing I'm qualified for is to string words together and make them sound pretty. I certainly don't know any more than most of you. Trust me, right? But just my thing, what I think. I think that we talk about the unmanageability of step one sometimes and we confuse it with step six. Because the unmanageability of step one has nothing to do with me living my life sober. It has everything to do with why I drink when I'm trying not to drink. Step six is the unmanageability of my life sober. Maybe we'll talk about that later. Maybe we won't. I don't know. But step one unmanageability is that, did you really spend the rent money on cocaine again? It seems unmanageable to me, right? Did you really not show up to work again? Did you really ignore that $30 ticket again, and now they want to lock you up again? I mean, is your life, basically the question is this, for whether or not my life is unmanageable. Is it by design? Are you living the life you would choose to live? Where you live? Or is it where you want to live? No, I'm sleeping on a friend's couch, right? Where you work, is that the job you want to work at? Or do you feel like you're a victim? Are you a victim of your life? Have you been pushed against your will to living a life you don't want to live? This is the unmanageability of alcoholism, that I'm under the lash of King Alcohol, and I've been pushed into a life that I don't want. And it was clear to me that that was the case, and step one was very, very easy for me. Step two is a little tricky. Step two is a little tricky. I'm that guy right out of the big book, right, where he says that he comes to AA and he finds out that we've got conferences and that people play softball and that there's meetings and we go to coffee and there are girls and he gets all excited about AA and then somebody says, and if you want to stay here, you got to find God. I mean, step two is really disappointing for me. Right? It just is, right? Because I find my people that drink like me, act like me, think like me, they're sober, their lives are doing good, and they say the answer is God, and I just can't get God. I'm not anti-God, I'm not against God, I just don't believe in God. It makes no sense to me. I told you I grew up in a Jewish home. We weren't really a Jewish home. We were an atheist Jewish home. Right? Now what that means is that we're Jews, but we know we're wrong. We eat bacon. We drive on holy days. Watch TV on Shabbat. I mean, we're not, right? But, so I know that, but we're nuts, right? The only people on the planet crazier than us are our Christian neighbors. Now, I want to point something out to you. Some of you laughed at the Jew part and were offended by the Christian part. And if you fall in that category, you have work to do. Right? Get busy! But I can't do the Jewish God and I can't do your God. First of all, you think my ancestors killed him, for crying out loud, right? I mean, I can't plug into that. I can't do nothing. I'm stuck. And I don't believe in it anyway. My sponsor said the craziest thing. He said, you don't have to believe in God to do step two. You don't have to believe in God to do step two. What are you talking about? He said, you don't have to believe in God to do step two. How can you not believe? How can you do step two? How can you do step two if you don't really do the whole thing? What are you talking about? He says, you don't have to believe in God to do step two, and I'm going to prove it to you. I want you to do something for me.
I want you to go out to the people in the group that you care about, that you like, that you love, that you have respect for, and ask them why they're sober.
Well, that's dumb. Because you all say the same thing. It's like they pass it out on a little card, right? If a new guy asks you why you're sober, say this. I'm sober today by the grace of a loving God that I found in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank God for AA, and I'd like to thank AA for God.
Brainwashed a lot of you. Now, I got to tell you something. If you want to know why I'm sober today, I'm sober today by the grace of a loving God that I found in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it is the thing, right? It is the thing. So I go back to them and I tell them I'm disappointed because they all said God. He said, let me ask you a question, John. If God keeps you sober, if God is what keeps you sober, and you could find him in step two or step three, why the hell would you do step four? I mean, it sucks. Seriously. Step four, nobody has ever said, yes, I'm writing a fourth step. Right? You know the new Kamaloka.
I'm on my fourth step.
Right? I mean, it's horrendous. And it's complicated, isn't it? Right? I mean, what do you do? Is it seven questions? Is it the workbook? Listen, if you're a big book thumper, right? I'm a big book guy. I love the big book. Some of us think it's four columns. Some think it's five. I found six. Right? Even the big book guys can't agree on how to write a goddamn false step, right? We're completely confused about what the thing looks. And if you do it wrong, you're going to die. Why would you do one of those unless you had to? Step five? Embarrassing. Six and seven, nobody understands six and seven. Eight and nine are incredibly expensive. Why would you do any of this stuff, right? Seriously. 10 and 11, so confusing. Half the people in this room think they're doing step 10 when they're really doing step 11. Now, you look around the room, some of you are going, huh? And some of them are going like this, right? The ones that are going, huh? Who cares? Doesn't matter. It's just words. Don't matter. Those of you that are like all proud of yourselves, that's called spiritual arrogance. You've got work to do. Work to do. You just love knowing shit no one else knows, right? And step 12, for crying out loud, if the pandemic has taught me anything, it's that there's a lot of good stuff on Netflix. I'm busy. I've even started Ozark. How can I do any 12-step work? Right? It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So he says, why would you do any of this stuff if you found God in two and three? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, it takes the steps to have the type of awakening that we're talking about here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he takes me to the big book. And he shows me the working part that I've come to believe is how you actually take step two. Now, there's some amazing writing about step two in the big book. That we agnostics know, it's mind-blowing, it's beautiful. There's other parts and other sections of the book that is beautiful spiritual writing that is about step two. But step two has action. And here's the action. It says this. We need to ask the new member one simple question. Do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, in a power greater than yourself? So you ask me the question, do you now believe? No, I don't. I do not believe in God. I don't. I do, no. I'm telling you, just, okay, we get it, Shelton, you don't believe. I don't believe in God. I do not believe in God. I will not believe in God. There's green eggs and ham, for crying out loud. There's no, we're not doing God here, right? Now, if the book said, do you now believe in God? If not, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go directly to jail. Go get drunk. Come back when you're reasonable, young man. When you're willing to, when you do, when alcohol is beating you up to where you believe in God. But it doesn't say that. It says, do I now believe in God or, which means I don't have to. Do I now believe in God, or am I even willing to believe in God? Do I now believe in God? No. Okay, are you even willing to believe in God? What does that mean? Are you willing to believe that just maybe perhaps it's possible? I know it's unlikely. I know it's a fairy tale. Santa Claus for grown-ups. I dig it. But is it possible that maybe there might be something in this universe more powerful than you that you might be able to rely upon and lean against? That you don't have to believe me, but is it at least possible?
Well, I guess. I mean, anything's possible, right?
I mean, I don't have to believe, do I? No, you don't have to believe, but you have to be willing to believe that maybe, just maybe, there might be possibly something, maybe.
Okay, I believe that maybe it's possible that there might be a God. I'm willing.
As soon as a man can see that he does believe, which I didn't, or he is willing to believe in a power greater than himself, we emphatically, what does that mean? Boom, baby, done. Step two, in the bag. Emphatically assure him he's on his way. You're done. This is not complicated. We love to make it complicated, right? We love to like expand on it and dig into it and poke at it. Primarily because that way I can pretend I know shit you don't know. Right? And my ego loves to know stuff you don't know. But, it's that simple. Well, if it's that simple, what do I do next? Say the prayer. Say the goddamn prayer. So wait a minute, you want me to turn my will and my life over to the care of something I don't believe in? Yes. I do. Well, won't that make me a hypocrite? Why, yes, it will. Sheldon, you have a list of character defects and problems that are going to kill you. Now, on that list, far down that list, is hypocrite. We'll get to it. We will. Probably about 30, 35 years sober, right? We'll get to hypocrite. We can start working on that character defect. But you got shit that wants you dead. So let's work on that stuff now. Say the goddamn prayer. Write the list. I'm going to share a little bit with you about my inventory. My first name, you know, if you're new and you're afraid to write your inventory, we could do it for you. You're not that unique, seriously, right? We could do it. We don't, because it's fun to watch you squirm, right? But it's just, you know, in no particular order, it's mom, dad, your siblings, whoever you slept with lately, whoever you worked for lately, and anybody else that's had any meaningless impact on your pathetic little life to this moment. I mean, it's not that complicated, right? So the first thing on my list is my dad. I hated my dad. He left when I was 2 years old. I hated him. He ruined my life. My dad ruined my life. Left when I was two. We became a poor family. I probably have alcoholism because of my dad. I hate my dad. Next, second name on the list. My mom. I hate my mom. My mom screams and yells. She's a big pain in the ass. She's got no, I mean, she's just, you know, always like angry all the time. I don't feel like she loves me at all. She always tells me that I remind her of my dad. And my dad ruined her life. And so, right, there's all this. And then I got all these other names on the list. But my dad and my mom are the first two main names on the list. And I show up at my sponsor's house with this inventory for step five, and he says, tell me about the first name on the list. And I tell him about my dad. And when I showed up to his house, he'd only had me write the first three columns. We did the next three columns together in the fifth step. So all my list said was who they were, what they'd done, and how it affected me. And it was a very effective way for him to do this with me. So I hate my dad, and my dad has committed all these crimes against me that I explained already, and it affects everything in my life. And then my sponsor says, there's a great part of the Bible about our sponsor says, this was our cause. This was our cause. We realized people offended or perhaps spiritually sick, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us. They, like ourselves, are sick too. This Sheldon is the point where we try to let your dad off the hook. We try to imagine if you were in his shoes, you know, could you have done the same thing? If have you ever behaved the same way? Is there a way you can get some compassion with your dad? Some people call it the sick man's prayer. And I'm not playing. No. My dad left. You don't understand. He ruined my life. I'm not interested. No. And we work on that a little bit. We came in and said, well, how about selfishness, honest, seeking, and afraid? Look, I was two. You're not going to tell me that it was my fault that my dad left, and you're not going to tell me that I should forgive my dad for leaving. The answer is no. I hate my dad. No. No. Eventually gave up. And he went to my mom. We talked about my mom, and my mom, as I said, would scream and yell a lot. It wasn't a very loving home. I'd come home from school, and I just didn't know what I was walking into. It was very confusing, and it was very difficult. And what was affected, everything was affected. And then he comes to this was our cost again. He said, this was our cost. We realized that people offended parents were sick. There were no things very disturbed, but they like ourselves were sick too. They like ourselves. And we started to talk about what it was like to be my mom. And I will tell you, the weirdest thing occurred to me. You know, I had never considered what it was like for my mom to be my mom. What I had done is I had given my mom a title of mom. Right? And that was her only title. She wasn't young woman. She wasn't person in the world. She wasn't person that might want a career, person that might want a relationship, person that might want some happiness or joy. She wasn't entitled to any of those titles. I gave her the title mom. Mom was her only title. She was mom. Then, without her permission, I wrote a list of attributes a mom should have. Did not get any input from her. None. None. Then I judged her against my list of attributes as to whether or not she was a good mom. This is what I did with my mom. I never considered what it might be like to be a woman who had been left by a husband with two young boys and no real means of supporting herself. I never imagined what it might have been like to be a woman getting divorced in the early 70s when it wasn't acceptable like it is today, especially not in that small Jewish community. I never once for a minute thought about what it might be like to be her. And then he hits me and he said, if you were your mom in that situation, how might you have reacted? I'm a runner, baby. I'm a runner. You make me a little uncomfortable. I'm out. I am out. If I was my mom, if it was possible to give the kids up for an orphanage or adoption, I'd have done it, right? I mean, my God, she hung in there with us. It changed my perception of my mom. And then we talked about dishonesty. And I already explained the dishonesty and the inconsideration. This didn't make me and my mom super close. This was not like the cure to our relationship. This was a crack in the dam that had kept me separated from my mom and kept me angry at my mom. It took many years for us to have a close relationship, and there were amends that I had to make that took a long time to make. But now my mom and I are very close. We talk most days. She just lost her husband of 40 years, and she lives near me, and we're together an awful lot. I'm not supposed to have this kind of relationship with my mom that I have, and it is beautiful, and I am grateful for it. And it all starts from this little tiny crack in the wall that separated me from my mom. And then he says, well, let's talk about your dad again for a minute. Oh, come on. You know what I think of that jerk. He goes, yeah, I know. He goes, let me ask you this. He says to me, your mom yells and screams a lot. She suffers with different kinds of mood swings and panic disorders. Do you think that started after the divorce, or could it have started before the divorce? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? I mean, you've built your life on this assumption that your dad ruined your life and that your dad's an evil man. What do you mean you don't know? What was it like for your dad? I never even considered it. I never even imagined what it might have been like for my dad in that marriage. The truth is that my dad was being sent into the Air Force. It was long after the Second World War, but they still had conscription in England. And what people would do is if they were dating, they would get married quickly before they went up to serve their time in the military. And my mom and dad didn't really know each other that well, and they got married. And my dad comes home to this marriage, and he finds out, perhaps, and I don't know, remember, this is all guesswork, But it's okay to guess because everything's guesswork because I don't know if the story I made up in the beginning is true. I need 10% of the information and I make up the rest. I've been doing it my whole life. Right? I don't know if what I know is true. I make up stories in my head. Let's make up a different story. Maybe your dad came home from his military service and he found out that for whatever reason, you and your mom did not get along. Oh, him and your mom did not get along. And maybe he stayed in that marriage as long as he could. But maybe what he saw when he looked at the rest of his life as a young man of 28, 29 years old, 30 years old, is that he thought he was going to have a gray, lonely, miserable existence. That he was going to be trapped in a bad marriage and have no joy, no fun, nothing. And that he was going to pay a price to marry a woman that he didn't really want to be married to. And he comes home one day and she says, I'm pregnant. So he stays. And he stays as long as he can and he thinks to himself, maybe I'll leave and get financially stable and then I'll send money and I'll take care of it. I can't stay. And then she comes home and she's pregnant again. And I'm the younger child. And he does it for as long as he can till he can't do it no more and then he leaves. Is it possible that your dad was pushed into the position of leaving, not because your mom's a bad person, but because they didn't get along? And because his vision for the rest of his life was sadness and angst? And is it possible that he didn't stay in that small town, that he moved to London, then Canada, then California? Because if it stayed in that small town, it would have been worse because of the embarrassment and the shame. So he went off on his life and he sent money and he did his best. And he stayed in contact with you kids. And when you were 16 years old and needed his help, he brought you to California and offered his help. Is it possible? I don't know. It's just as good of a story as the one I made up. I don't know. What would you have done if you were your dad? I'm a runner. Right? She'd have come home pregnant with the first kid, and I'd have said, well, good luck with that. Are you keeping it? Good luck with that. Right? I mean, geez, you know? What would I say? I want to talk a little bit about dishonesty with my dad. I know we're kind of running out of time here. I want to talk a little bit about dishonesty with my dad. This is not a lesson of my original foster. This is a lesson of further on in the process and years of inventory and looking at stuff. But I told you several times my dad ruined my life, didn't he? My dad, guilty. I want to tell you something, though. I have a good life. I do. I'm sober 25 years. I'm active in my home group. I sponsor guys. I have a sponsor. I have a connection with God. And my life is good. I own my own business. It's been difficult through COVID, but I think we're going to be okay. I own my own business. I was married for 20 years to a woman who is a great woman. A great woman. We have an amazing son together. That marriage ran its course, and I'm no longer married to that woman, but I respect her, and I appreciate what she did with our son, and she's a great woman. My son is an absolute champion. This kid is self-employed at 20 years old, making more money than most of my friends. The guy's a rock star. He's amazing. I have a great girlfriend who I adore. And I have a good life. My life is good. Would you like to know why? I know what you're thinking. You're thinking because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous by the grace of God. And then, no, listen, that's true. That is true. It is true that without God in my life, and Alcoholics Anonymous, that my life wouldn't look as great as it does. That is true. But if my dad had not left my mom, I'd still be living in the freezing cold north of England where I was raised. I'd be a market worker in that crappy little town, which is what him and my grandfather did. I may or may not be sober, but it wouldn't be this home group with this sponsor and these sponsees. I may or may not have my own company, but it wouldn't be this company. I wouldn't have this son. I might have a son, but he's half her, and she was never in the north of England. Everything in my life that I like exists because my dad left when I was two. And he moved to Southern California, and I followed him there, and I have a life built on the fact that my parents got divorced.
My life doesn't exist without that divorce. Was it the worst thing he ever did? Or could it possibly have been, in God's universe, the best thing he could have done for all of us? I don't know. But I have acted like I know, with resentment, anger, separation, and poison inside of me for long enough. Long enough. When my dad died, I held his hand as he drifted off. And we were good. And we were good. My mom, she's good. My brother, we're good. Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to repair the difficult primary relationships in my life through principles and through working the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Forgiveness does not mean, listen to this, because I made this, and I'm not trying to preach. I am preaching. I'm not trying to preach, right? But I'm doing it, aren't I, right? But anyway, I misunderstood the word forgiveness for decades, and it nearly killed me. Forgiving someone doesn't mean their behavior was acceptable. It means the opposite. You don't have to forgive acceptable behavior, right? Because acceptable behavior is acceptable, right? There's no forgiving acceptable behavior. Forgiveness means you're wrong and I love you anyway. You're wrong and it's okay because I make mistakes too. And forgiveness doesn't mean I will forgive you as long as you don't do it again. Because that denies your nature. Forgiveness means I forgive you expecting you to do it again. Now I will protect myself as much as I can against the fallout of your knuckleheadedness. And I recommend you protect yourself from the fallout of my knuckleheadedness. But let's at least love each other for our humanity and our knuckleheadedness. Do I have 5 more minutes?
Sure.
I was going to take it anyway. I just bring the mic. I got the microphone, but thank you for being on my side. That guy John, all those years ago, asked me what I wanted out of AA, and I told you I didn't know. So it's been a weird year, hasn't it? Right? Pandemic and all this other nonsense going on. I'll tell you, my last 3 years have been very strange. This divorce. This divorce occurred because we had become roommates, and I didn't have the nerve to tell her that I wasn't happy and to ask for corrections in our marriage, like marriage counseling or whatever. I pretended everything was okay. And I ended up being unfaithful to her. And it's always funny when I say that, because like some of the women in the crowd are like, oh, he's so wonderful. And then I say that and they go, except the ones I really like, they go, oh. It is AA after all. And I'm sorry, I apologize. So I was unfaithful to my wife. It was very embarrassing and very difficult, and we ended up with a divorce, which is very difficult and very expensive and very embarrassing. And it was a terrible, terrible thing. A terrible, terrible thing. My 17-year-old son had to help. We had to navigate that. Very, very difficult. 3-4 years ago now. Then my business partner, because I bought him out since, but at the time I had a partner, he just gets scared and he empties all the money out of the bank account. And just didn't steal it. He just puts it to the side, is what he said. But he emptied the business bank account. And then they did all this construction in front of my business. And I'm in the retail car business, right? And so they sent the traffic there. It was very, very difficult. And then the pandemic hit, right? Which is crazy. They say if your business is has pre-existing conditions, right? We had pre-existing conditions of the yin yang. And very, very difficult. And then on April of 2020, I'm going to meet a customer for an appointment, and I start to feel funny, and it turns out that I have a stroke, the kind of stroke that doesn't ever leave you with symptoms, but it gives you a seizure, and in the seizure I shake so hard, I explode the L4 vertebrae in my back and break my shoulder, and they don't know if I'm a stroke candidate, if I'm a seizure guy. They know they're not operating on my back till they can figure it out. I'm now going to work on a walker to lay on the mattress in one of the back rooms of the dealership and work from a laptop, and it's just a disaster, and I'm
freaked out, right, as you can imagine. I don't believe in that situation when fear knocks, if faith answers, there's nobody there. I think you're lying to yourself if you believe that. In my life, when fear knocks, me and faith go, we can take you, you son of a bitch, come on in, right, is what happens in my life. But anyway, right, so I'm laying in bed in my apartment, and I got all this going on, and I'm terrified. And I go into prayer and meditation. It started in my toes. Crawled up my legs to my belly and over my head. And it was calming. And it was soothing. And it was purple. It even tasted like purple. When you talk about these overwhelming spiritual experiences, somebody that hasn't experienced anything like it, you sound like a fool, and I'm willing to sound like a fool to tell you the story. I've had 3 or 4 of them in my life. I've had lots of mini little ones, right? The butterfly that goes, oh, look, it's God. But I mean, like real, real powerful ones, right? I have this real powerful God consciousness. I felt calm. And it went away after a few minutes. Not really, because it's still with me today, because I'm sharing about it, but the intensity of it went away after a couple of minutes. And I'm talking to a guy that I sponsor. And he wants me to explain to him what it felt like. And all I could tell him was it was peace. It was peace. He goes, come on, what did it feel? And this is what I came up with. This is what it felt like. When John asked me that question all those years ago, what do you want out of AA? This is what I would have liked to have told him. I want to know that AA works. I want to know it works. I want to know that if I come to AA and I work the steps and I get a sponsor and I get involved and I do everything, I buy the whole package, I want to know that I will be able to stay sober and comfortable in my own skin most of the time. I want to know that it works. And for it to work, that is going to have to mean that God is real. I want to know AA works, and I want to know that God is real. And in my bed, with all this emotion going on, I knew. I knew that AA worked. And I knew that God was real. And I didn't know it then for the first time. I'd known it for years. I knew it when my dad died. I just didn't have the words to put to it. I knew it when my wife was pregnant 4 times. We have 1 son. Seeing heartbeats, not seeing heartbeats are difficult. Business problems, family problems, all the stuff that makes up life. So much stuff I can't even remember half of it, right? I knew through all of it. I knew that AA works and God is real. And God is real and He is in the room. He is real and He is in the room and AA works. If I came here to share anything with you, it is in this humble drunk's opinion, AA works. God is real and He's in the room. Guys, I know I'm in the South. And I know that Southern hospitality means you're going to want to come up and hug on me and love on me. And for your safety and for mine, I would like to tell you that I cannot do a receiving line tonight. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your time.